From Wisconsin Public Radio, this is Newsmakers. I'm Ezra Wall in our Southwest Bureau at the University of Wisconsin La Crosse. Thank you very much for joining us today. It's a COVID-19 update. We're checking in with different members of our community on the spread of COVID-19 through La Crosse County and the surrounding area. In the first part of today's show, we're going to get the latest reaction from the Mayo Clinic Health System and Gunderson Health System. Then later on, we'll hear from the leaders of three area colleges, and they'll talk about public health and life on campus this year in 2020. But like I said, first, we're turning our attention to the healthcare industry, and we're going to hear from Megan Meller, who's an infection preventionist at Gunderson Health System, and Dr. Joseph Podoruka, who's the chair of the ICU at the Mayo Clinic Health System in La Crosse. Thank you both for joining us today very much. I appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me.
Happy to be here there.
So first off, we've seen COVID rates really on the rise in southwestern Wisconsin. After the first couple of months, we had people being really, really careful at the slightest tick of an increase. And then we were talking about just a few cases a week in La Crosse County, even less in some of the surrounding counties. Now we're seeing many times more than that each day in the county, and yet people are running about town, and some of them are being more careful than others. Starting with you, Dr. Podoruka, what are you seeing in the community that gives you the most concern when it comes to COVID-19?
Yeah, great question, Ezra. So, you know, we're seeing a steady uptick in the case rate, so per 100,000 people, but, you know, that's really translating into what we're now seeing in the last week's burden on the healthcare system. Yesterday, in fact, we reached our highest number of hospitalized patients up in the 70 range, and it's really putting a burden on the practice. I know our colleagues at Gunderson are kind of rating their capacity at the yellow level. Mayo is at a green level, the way we look at the Cooley Collaborative metrics, but we expect that to become even more pressing. So in the next 2 to 4 weeks, each week, we're anticipating increased census of roughly 25% increases. And this is kind of twofold. One is the demand from outside of La Crosse County. So they are kind of closing up shop northwest, north central Wisconsin. They, in fact, in Eau Claire, they're kind of putting off elective surgeries. So we're seeing an influx of outside of the Driftless Valley coming to us. At the same time, an uptick in cases and then hospitalized patients. And when these patients get here, a lot of them have underlying medical issues and they stick around for weeks. It's very difficult to get them back out of the hospital if they survive. And the additional burden comes at the level of long-term care with the nursing homes, assisted living. Outbreaks there are preventing patients from having outflow from the hospital, which backs things up even more. So we are concerned. There's certain things that are at risk looking ahead, and I would conjecture that the hospital resources are threatened. You know, there is risk that there could be postponement of elective cases, surgeries, procedures. There's risk of running out of beds for people that actually need it. There's risk of not having enough staff, hospital staff available as they come down with issues with COVID or quarantine issues, and ultimately preventable deaths. So we are concerned looking ahead, and I know our Gunderson colleagues echo that as well.
Megan, when we look at all of the different data points that are available to members of the public, we see people understanding some of it, misunderstanding other things, drawing both helpful and unhelpful conclusions based on that. Earlier on, the health professionals in our community, including the health department, were releasing like daily, like this many tests today and this many infections and whatever specific numbers in the county. Now they're doing it, you know, once a week with more of a kind of a cases per 100,000 population sort of thing. So it seems maybe less tangible to people who are not used to looking at that kind of data. What should people be looking for when they're looking at all the information available to them? What number should they really be latching on to as far as this is how I know how bad it is in my community?
So So you really touch on a really good point, is, you know, the ever-changing world of stats. And, you know, in the beginning, we didn't have the testing capacity. And so it was, you know, I think the numbers were a little bit deceiving because we knew we weren't capturing the true picture of the COVID burden in our community. You know, now having the data reported in that per 100,000 is very quite meaningful because it's kind of like the great equalizer across populations. And so it's easier to make comparisons between larger counties like Dane County, where you have more of a population, compared to La Crosse County or even Trempealeau County. You know, I remember hearing nurses and even doctors within our organization in the beginning saying, well, it can't be that bad. We haven't had any deaths from La Crosse County yet. But what, and I think the community was kind of feeling the same thing, you know, feeling kind of we escaped, you know, we were kind of in the clear. But what they weren't realizing was, you know, Mayo and Gunderson, we serve a much larger population than just La Crosse County. You know, we serve a tri-state area. And so we weren't having COVID-19 deaths. And it was really kind of hard to convey that burden, you know, at that time. You know, back in September, we were averaging about 6 COVID-19 hospitalizations. And now we're up to 38, you know, and so we've had to open up more units and, you know, restructure staffing and, revamp units just to take on this case burden. And, you know, in addition to that, you know, echoing Dr. Hedaruka's comments about what's happening across the state, is hospitals are filling up and we're having to, you know, we're taking on transfers from, you know, Eau Claire, from Stevens Point, from these different hospitals because they can't take these patients. And I think that's really what I wanted to try to get across to people is, like, this is very real, and now is the time that we need to act because it may only get worse from here, especially as we head into the holiday season.
Earlier on, Dr. Podoruka, when testing was so limited, and really it took an act of Congress to get a test, it felt like to some people. But now those tests are more widely available. And the health department is even saying at the public testing events that they're holding in different places through the listening area that people who are even not symptomatic can go ahead and get in line and get a test. So why should someone, when someone's considering whether that's right for them to do, what should be the criteria in their mind? If they don't have symptoms, why should someone consider getting tested for COVID?
Again, great question. It's prevalent in our community. We know that. We have the testing capability now. You want to know if you have the COVID-19 because this has an impact downstream. The downstream is, you know, where the transmission is occurring. So, you know, early on when September hit and the college surge came in, it was those younger individuals getting into the vulnerable places like the nursing homes, the assisted living. You know, now we're seeing a shift. It's not just the young people. Now it's the middle age, and it's really focused on behaviors. When we think about getting testing, it kind of translates to that contact, the tracing, trying to understand where these outbreaks are occurring. And we're kind of seeing at the behavioral level. Now, you know, larger outbreaks are being noticed at get-togethers and homes, dinner parties, daycares, weddings. And this is the intersection of vulnerable populations. And this can really transact at those rural communities, not just at the city level. And you got to be able to contact trace these cases so we can target the vulnerable and mitigate those areas as needed, whether it's a long-term nursing home, assisted living, the college dorms, businesses. This is where we can make some focal interventions to kind of limit the spread. So we're really lucky that the testing burden, while it has been complex with the case rate going up, but we have the available resources to understand where the virus is kind of spreading and make inroads to mitigate it.
Dr. Joseph Podoruka there, who's the chair of the Mayo Clinic ICU here in La Crosse. Megan Meller joins us as well, an infection preventionist at Gunderson Health System. And our conversation will continue in just a moment. We've been talking about COVID-19, getting a little bit of an update about what that looks like in our community. We will talk about the elephant in the room, or the turkey rather. Thanksgiving is coming up, and yet The latest guidance from health officials still says you shouldn't be hanging out with people that you don't live with. We'll talk about it next here on Newsmakers. If you'd like more information about our show, find our website at WPR.org/newsmakers. This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. Once again, it's Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Ezra Wall in our La Crosse studio. Thank you for joining us for our conversation today about COVID-19, getting the latest from a couple of healthcare professionals here in the first part of our show. Then later, we will hear from the presidents of Western Technical College and Viterbo University and the chancellor of the University of Wisconsin, La Crosse. That's in the second half of the show. Joining me in this segment again, Dr. Joseph Podoruka, the chair of ICU at Mayo Clinic in La Crosse. Megan Meller, an infection preventionist at Gunderson Health Systems. Thank you very much for joining us. And our conversation continues because just the Cooley COVID-19 Collaborative has been keeping everybody up to date on how things are going and came out with a warning just this week about how important it is to maintain all of the precautions that they've been urging in spite of or maybe because of Thanksgiving coming up, when everybody is going to be tempted to gather with their family. Megan, people have been reducing their social activity for months now, and the temptation for so many of them is going to be absolutely irresistible to assume that, hey, my family is not going to be a big problem. There's only going to be 20 or 30 of us, and it's the same ones that we always see. Why can't we just get together?
Oh, I know. And this is a really hard one. I always look forward to the season and, you know, to the holiday season. And especially, you know, with how, you know, this year has been, you know, I think we just crave that, you know, that familial, that family contact. But now is not the time to get complacent. We really need to recognize that the COVID-19 symptoms can really be insidious. I've seen people who have, you know, they're positive for COVID, but all they had was a sinus infection, or they thought it was bad allergies, or they had a headache, like very mild symptoms. And I think this can cause some people to write their symptoms off and say, oh, it's just a cold, and still feel like they can get together. And we also know that asymptomatic and pre-symptomatic spread of COVID is really real, where, you know, if someone doesn't have any symptoms and they're still able to spread it. And this is why we're really strongly encouraging people to stay put for the holidays and, you know, maybe look at it as a way to create new traditions. You know, there's also virtual, you know, the technology today is brilliant. And so we can do those virtual visits with our family and still stay connected and be present without having that in-person care. Realizing, too, that this is just 1 year and one holiday. And if it means keeping our loved ones healthy and safe this season, and then we get to spend many more holidays with them, then I think that's really the mindset we have to be, is realizing that this is just a temporary state.
Let me push back at that for just a second and just playing the devil's advocate here. That sounds great, but you know that's not going to be the reality. Like, there's a certain percentage of the people, and it seems to me like it might be a fairly high percentage of the people, who are just not going to do that. They're going to go visit aunts, uncles, cousins, family, whoever it is for Thanksgiving. Is there a way to do that safely?
You know, I think there is. You know, again, recognizing that it's not advised, but there are still ways to do it safely. You know, in the beginning, we talked about quarantine bubbles, or, you know, even COVID bubbles, you know, where everyone makes the same agreement saying, I'm going to limit my social contact with other groups of people and just only interact with you. And so you're kind of creating your own sort of social bubble where you're kind of isolated from everyone else, but you can still, as a family, interact. There's that as an option. Again, it's looking, ventilation is a huge piece to COVID transmission, and which is why, you know, outdoors is such a great place to interact with someone, you know, where we could hang out with family in parks or in backyards. Winter gets a little bit tricky, especially in Wisconsin, although right now it's, you know, we're having an abnormally warm week in November. But it could be opening up windows, turning on fans, you know, any way to increase the ventilation inside the house and reduce particles, you know, potential virus particles. And even, again, trying to maintain that social distance within a house. So looking at seating arrangements to make sure that, again, you're not right on top of each other, but you're still able to be in the same room while keeping a safe distance. So there are things that, you know, we can do, you know, you can do to lower your risk of getting together for the holidays, but realize that the risk of getting together and getting COVID is still going to be greater than choosing to forego that this year.
We've been seeing admonitions for people to get their flu shots as flu season approaches. And I know the flu shot doesn't do anything to prevent COVID-19, but why might this year, Dr. Podoruca, be a particularly important year for people to remember to get inoculated against the flu?
Oh, great point. Great question. Ezra, get your flu shot. Get it yesterday. We don't know what COVID plus influenza looks like. That could be a disaster. We know vulnerable patients with comorbidities getting influenza alone is an issue, but compound that with COVID, we could be in for a big issue with mortality, morbidity, and then burden on the hospital system. Again, now is the time to change behavior. The hospitals are stressed. They are becoming overwhelmed. With our crude modeling, we're anticipating 25% increase in hospital census each week, not even beginning to think about, like was mentioned, the influx from the rest of Wisconsin or the issues of outflow getting to our assisted living, nursing home, rehab centers. We got to change behavior. And when you look at those smaller gatherings, yes, it's tempting. Like she said, this is one holiday, one season. The vaccine, you know, whether it comes this spring, summer, or fall, we know COVID is going to be around here. And we know you have some loved ones that are vulnerable, aunts, uncles, mothers, fathers, grandmas, grandfathers. They are vulnerable in these family gatherings. This is where we are seeing the intersection COVID and the hospitalizations. It's no longer the college kids to blame. It's the middle age. It's these family social gatherings, dinner parties, weddings. This is going to be phase two. And we're already seeing the burden at the healthcare level. Think about elective care being a burden. If you need to go to the ER, if you have a heart attack, strokes, if you need to go have a baby, if you need to have general preventative care, screening for cancer, this is where the hospital and our health systems are going to be burdened. And we have a collective responsibility to make it right. And now is the time to act.
I'm glad you mentioned college students being blamed earlier on for some of the spread. And indeed, we did see in our community some college students engaging in risky behavior. Maybe this might be a question for the college presidents I'm having on in the next segment. But since you are healthcare professionals, I'll ask you: are college students being unfairly demonized in all of this? It seems like kind of a red herring with talk of spread from family to family and within households and the avoidance of family gatherings. It seems like college students aren't the only ones at risk here.
Clearly, you know, there was that uptick in the surge. The intersection to burden of deaths and hospitalizations was in the occupational setting of those young people. It shifted. It's gotten into rural communities and into the middle age group where generally, we're not seeing some of the same behaviors we've been trying to model ahead in hygiene, masks, et cetera. So we can't demonize the young people anymore. This is Wisconsin behavior, and we're seeing it across all age groups, young and old.
Megan, what about from your perspective, what populations that might have thought, oh, this is if as long as I don't behave like a college student, this isn't going to be a problem for me. But other adults can engage in risky behaviors too, right?
Absolutely, you know, and we're seeing the exact same thing on our end too. You know, back in September, we were seeing, you know, it was primarily like with college age students, but now it's much more across the whole entire board. You know, I'd say on a day-to-day basis, maybe only one or two college students are testing positive compared to, you know, that older group. So like the 50-year-old, the 60-year-old population, because, you know, again, we want, I think it's that general need to be together and we have to change behaviors because, you know, I always look forward to the holiday season and this year I'm not looking forward to it because I know that after Thanksgiving, after Christmas, we're going to see that uptick in cases, and we're already at capacity within Gunderson. And even someone who just has a mild symptoms, if they think that they're fine, you know, they got it easy doesn't mean that that people they interact with aren't going to respond the same way. And that's exactly what's playing out right now within our own communities, as we're seeing this burden shift to the older population. We're seeing our hospitalization rates go up. We're seeing our fatality rates go up too.
That's Megan Meller, an infection preventionist at Gunderson Health System. We're also joined this segment by Dr. Joseph Podruka, the chair of the ICU at Mayo Clinic Health System in La Crosse. I want to thank you both for joining us today and sharing some valuable information. I'm certain we'll be in touch again as our community continues to face the different ways of dealing with COVID-19. But for today, thank you both very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Ezra Wall, and I invite you to check out our website if you'd like to listen to part of this conversation again or stream on demand a past program. That's WPR.org/newsmakers. You can check out our show, which is a podcast that exists on many of your favorite podcast platforms. Open it up, search for Newsmakers, and hit subscribe. I'll be very thankful if you do that. Coming up, we're hearing from leaders of three college campuses and talk about public health and life on campus here in 2020. That's coming up as Newsmakers continues on Wisconsin Public Radio. Wisconsin Public Radio. This is Newsmakers. I'm Ezra Wall in our Southwest studios, located, as it were, at the University of Wisconsin La Crosse, and we are joined to talk about that university and other area colleges' a response to COVID-19. I'm pleased to have three guests with me this half hour. Joe Gao is the Chancellor of the University of Wisconsin La Crosse. Glenna Temple is the President of Viterbo University in La Crosse, and Roger Stanford is the President of Western Technical College. Welcome to the three of you, and thank you so much for agreeing to spend some time with me today. I'd like to get your reflections on what was going through your mind when you started hearing about this pandemic, when you started realizing it was something that could affect your campus, and kind of how prepared were you? Let's start with Dr. Stanford. Dr. Stanford, what about Western? How prepared were you for a pandemic that could lead to a shutdown, could lead to students being off campus, and so on?
Well, we've got a lot of resiliency planning, and we had actually had a pandemic tabletop exercise scheduled the week it all hit. It's kind of the irony there. We went from a tabletop exercise to actually living it. I don't know that anyone was prepared to completely flip everything online, but we were blessed with that. We had a lot of good infrastructure and technology and training and development and in, say, the software, where we had the ability to make a move pretty quickly. So I feel pretty lucky that those things were able to happen. But we certainly had a bumpy couple of weeks as we had to just make that transfer like everybody else. So forcing our colleges to shut down for a week so we could put all those things into play was a key part. So we were better prepared than I would have guessed we were. But the initial thought was, wow, what's the next step?
Chancellor Joe Gao from UWL, I have the opportunity to work on your campus daily, and it's where my office is. And so I've seen some of the communication with staff that goes on and other ways that the campus dealt with COVID-19 as it was coming on. What surprised you about that? How prepared were you for an international pandemic to really hit home here in La Crosse?
Well, I don't think many people were prepared, because if somebody would have told you how this would unfold, I don't know that you would believe it. And it's a very, of course, unusual virus that has deadly impact on some people and minimal impact on others. And so, you know, we really never envisioned anything quite like that. And I would echo what my colleague Roger said. You know, we're very fortunate that we have very flexible and dedicated people teaching and helping students. that could make transitions to have things at a distance on a really very short notice. So that was something we had obviously never done before, but now we know we have the ability to do that. So I suppose if there is anything that has been positive to come out of this, it's to have that experience.
I know that I know that the perception in the community, at least for a long time, regarding Viterbo University, Dr. Temple, is that it's a smaller campus, perhaps a tighter community in that way. For a long time, Viterbo it was known as a liberal arts college, and now offers many opportunities in terms of nursing, and is getting bigger programs involved in the sciences and that sort of thing. Talk about your campus's reaction to COVID-19. What happened on Viterbo's campus when the pandemic hit?
Well, like my colleagues, we were lucky that we had some pandemic planning and scenarios in place that helped guide us in the early days. And I think another thing that was in our favor is we had quite a bit of online instruction on campus before, so our faculty were prepared for the flip to online for the most part, although we did rapid training, as I know my colleagues did on their campuses as well. I do think you're correct that our size allowed us to be more flexible and meet the individual student needs in some cases of boxing up belongings and doing things that would just be very difficult on a larger campus. So I do think smaller classes and a smaller student body provided some assistance there. I will say a place that we had to navigate really carefully, as you identify, with all of our health science programs and our labs. Hands-on curriculum is essential to what we do, as I know it is in my colleagues' institutions as well, but a very large proportion of our students were actively engaged in placements in the community. So figuring out how to do clinicals and practicums at a distance and get the same learning outcome, and how to work with our accreditors who were also trying to adjust to the pandemic, was an interesting, I think, somewhat unique feature for us as we had to make the adjustment, doing so without the guidance of some of those accrediting bodies that are essential to the work we do.
Dr. Temple raises the issue of hands-on learning, and I know that every institution of higher learning has aspects of that go into the programs, but I can't think of an institution that is known for the necessity of hands-on practical experience quite like a technical college like Western. Dr. Stanford, how challenging was it how did those programs that Western has that rely on that hands-on instruction and experience, how have they been able to adapt?
I think they've done exceptionally well, and that was our commitment to as safe as we can be. And what I mean by that is there are no guarantees when you have to bring people together, but we made a commitment to move what could be online, but recognizing, as you said, technical education is a unique animal. You can't be a law enforcement officer without some face-to-face. You can't do that in respiratory therapy or diesel or woods or welding. You've got to touch materials. You have to practice skills. And so what we did was we moved two-thirds of what we do fully online. We already probably had 20% online, but we had to move a lot. And then what we had to do is really look at the conditions of what we needed to do face-to-face and say, how do we meet what would be required or recommended by our health department, by the CDC? And I'm just really proud of what the program directors and our deans did. As far as we did make some smaller class sizes, we did make a lot of adjustments to labs. We do have absolute strict policies related to safety, the gear, what they have to wear. And because of it, we've been lucky to have a pretty low amount of active cases, and remains lower than some of the places around the country by strict adherence to those. So a third of our students do have to have some form of face-to-face. And so it's crucial that when we do that, that we're following the guidelines and working with public health to make sure that we're delivering that in a way and the best opportunity we can to be safe. And we've got an absolute commitment to the PPE and social distancing commitment.
It's just part of the modern education space that some instruction and other kinds of follow-up interaction with teachers, professors, everybody else will be online, and so that infrastructure pretty much exists on campuses across the country and the world. But in terms of just how many people had to access those services, I think that's where we saw the steep increase at the end of the last school year, and certainly as this semester commenced. Dr. Gao at UWL, how much of a shift was that for UWL? How many of the students are online versus previously?
Well, that was a major transition for us, as I suspect it was for my colleagues' institutions. And right now, there are a significant number, over half the courses are either online or in a hybrid format, which is a combination of online and in-person. Very small number, but significant of in-person classes that are that kind of hands-on that you talked about previously. Things like laboratories and music instruction and those kind of things. So this is something that was a little new to us. It was fortunate that it initially came at the spring break last semester, because that gave us the opportunity this summer to get all our faculty trained in distance education teaching, because some of them had never done it before, and we wanted to make sure they were able to do it to the best possible ability. And so we're in that position now. So, that has been helpful.
We're talking today on Newsmakers with three heads of our local campuses here in La Crosse. We have Chancellor Joe Gao from the University of Wisconsin-La Crosse, President Glenna Temple from Viterbo University, and President Roger Stanford from Western Technical College. I'm so pleased to have them join us today on Newsmakers. Our show will continue in just a moment, but first let me remind you, if you would like to stream on demand part of this program that you might have missed, or a part of any previous program that we've aired, you can find them all at our website, which is wpr.org/newsmakers. We're in a lot of the popular podcasting apps, too. All you got to do is open your favorite platform, search for Newsmakers, and when you find us, I hope you hit subscribe. Thank you very much. And we'll be right back. This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Ezra Wall in our Southwestern Bureau. Thank you very much for listening today. Our conversation about college and university response to COVID-19 continues with Dr. Roger Stanford, the president of Western Technical College, Dr. Glenna Temple, the president of Viterbo University, and Dr. Joe Gao, who's the chancellor of the University of Wisconsin-La Crosse. I want to talk to each of you about I don't want to put a negative light on it, but some, you know, aspects of this that took you by surprise, or aspects of this that as a work in progress, maybe didn't go as well as planned at first. Dr. Gao, I know a thing that comes to mind for people in the community. I know that we started with welcoming students to campus at the beginning of the semester when there was a little bit of a spike in virus activity. Everything was moved back online for a period of time, and now people are back on campus and things are going well. What was that like for you and your staff as you began to realize that maybe things weren't going as planned earlier in the semester?
Well, when we started back this semester, we did have the capability in place at that point to test all the students living in our residence halls. And we began doing that, and we found some high numbers that we were very, very concerned about. So, yes, we did have to take a pause there for 2 to 3 weeks and put everything online and have people just stay in their residence halls. And I think that was really helpful to get the attention of our campus community and just remind everybody we just have to wear masks, distance, avoid getting into groups, wash our hands. Those are fundamental things that we just are going to be needing to do and do for some time. And so we're very relieved to see that Now the numbers are much, much lower. You can go to our COVID dashboard on the website and see the daily count. And, you know, I really have to commend in particular our students for taking this very seriously and changing their behaviors and making sure they're doing everything they can to avoid the spread of the virus.
Dr. Stanford, at Western, I know, at least again, based on my own perception and what's that worth, that and a dollar will get you a Coke at a Quick Trip. but based on my own perception, you know, I've always assumed that Western might have fewer residential students because of the kinds of education programs that you have. But how has your campus reacted to COVID-19 in terms of, is there something, a lesson that you've learned that you didn't anticipate or something that didn't go as well as you expected?
I would say the lesson as a mistake, but more of an epiphany through the transition is we started with some early videos out to our staff and students with some real basic information. And we realized quickly that communication was never more important than it was during COVID. And I think it's always been a part of our business model. It should have been there, but I don't think we were doing the job with our coworkers and with our students that we've done in COVID. And I think that'll carry on regardless of where we're at in a pandemic, the level of communication. We don't have a week go by that we don't have direct communications with our students, whether that be a video or an email. And the same with our coworkers. We really invested in that. And what we've found is a lot of maybe calm that comes with being transparent and communicating regularly, whether that's about the numbers, whether that's about the safety protocols, which, as we know, things have shifted and changed. And whether that's about which programs are going to do what, we've committed to communication. And for me, as a lesson of always knowing, you know, communications are important, but I don't think I realized how effective they could be at a time like this and how crucial it is in somebody feeling safe, engaged, when they're just doing work of a lifetime right now. So I'm just going to go to how valuable I think it was that we engaged our coworkers with some really strong communications, and they were a part of that.
Dr. Temple, what about Viterbo? What would you classify what would you put in that maybe hard learned lessons category or something that did not go according to plan? You've been able to adjust and move forward.
Thanks for the opportunity. I think two things come to mind. We did really robust planning over the summer as we geared up for this, and I think we learned that even though we did all that planning, things have changed daily and our approaches and what we need to do. And again, like my colleagues, grateful for staff that could adjust over time. Two things that surprised me. One, we offered up single dorm rooms to our freshmen over the summer and really tried to de-densify. And we did that, but I was surprised how many students wanted to stay with a member, another person in their dorm room in this situation. So that surprised me and caused us to adjust our planning. I think another is we set up a robust testing program with PCR-based testing with Mayo Clinic as our partner, even with our off-campus students right off the bat. And I was surprised by how many asymptomatic students we picked up through the screening. I mean, I knew there was a reasonable proportion in this population, but I was surprised by the high number that right in the door, so from their previous experience, brought that. And I am grateful with Mayo, we got very fast turnaround in the testing results so we could quickly isolate and quarantine. And that seems to be the key to our success of now we're down to a very low number of positives in our random screening, and our positivity rate, our 7-day positivity rate, is only at 1% through our random PCR screening. So it seems like that robust entry testing and very quick turnaround to be able to quarantine and isolate, along with what my colleagues talked about. Our students are highly motivated to stay in their clinicals and keep playing their sports, so they're adhering to the rules much better than I expected them to. So I think those have been some lessons learned from Viterbo's end.
I know that, you know, college students are college students, and they haven't had the opportunity that many of us have as adults to learn what it's like to be you know, part of a community and to feel that level of responsibility for neighbors. And I know some college students or college age people have been criticized for some of their weekend behavior and everything like that. Talk about those students. We'll start with Dr. Temple, but talk about how as a university, as an institution, you can't babysit students who are adults like you could if they were in junior high or elementary school, certainly. So how can you impress upon them the importance of being responsible when they are out in the community and behave in ways that don't put more people at risk?
Yeah, I think we teach a course that's required of all of our students about the common good. And so all of our students have had this framework of trying to be citizens and understand the interconnectedness and this concept of the common good. I also think we have the benefit of over half of our students being nursing students who understand and really embrace the seriousness of the pandemic has also assisted us. Like many schools, we really tried to educate that we're all in this together, and we have some peer advocates trying to change behavior of students as well. And we also changed our code of conduct to expect the behaviors that we observe. So it's been many different steps to try to get our students to understand the greater good. And really, these are students who are already in clinicals, working in hospitals, many of them who really understand, are screened regularly, and are committing their lives to careers to keep people healthy. So I think that's assisted Viterbo.
Dr. Gao, how has that gone with UWL, convincing young people who many of them are adults on their own for the first time, and a lot of them living off campus, or even the ones who do live on campus? You know, you can't monitor them every minute of every day. How do you teach them to be responsible members of the community?
Well, that's right, Ezra. And I think actually this experience is doing that very thing, reminding our students that, you know, they are responsible members of the community. They have a key role to play. They have to do their part, and that's been our message throughout. I think I saw once where when you combine the students at our three institutions, that one out of every fourth person in La Crosse is a college student or a university student. So it's a critical population for the La Crosse community, and we are always reminding our students of that that's never been more true than right now.
I want to give each of you a chance. We'll start with Dr. Stanford to talk about how things are now on campus. Your sense of how things are going now and into the second semester, looking forward to the second semester of this year.
Sure, and we are going to probably mirror what our fall efforts are and continue with the safe path we're on into the spring. But this would, I think your question leads me to do a shout out for my coworkers, because I think what they've done by creating safer conditions, we have a COVID monitoring team that has really guided most of it and most of the safety. And then we've got advisors and faculty members and counselors and people that have figured out how to provide services, support, coaching, mentoring, tutoring to each other and to the students that they have in an extraordinary environment, and it's actually working. So I think all of those things at a distance, we will continue to do as much of our business as a distance safely as we can. But I think we also got to think about the long-term model, and we have to start planning and forecasting, you know, how long might this happen, and where might we have to make additional lab adjustments so that if this goes into another year, we can continue by more face-to-face, bringing more in, because students do want that. And how do we do that safer if this is to extend another year? I think that's where we have to start forecasting and looking at it. But I just have to shout out, our faculty have been extraordinary. The support that all of our boots-on-the-ground people that give directly to students, it has absolutely been amazing. And I'm just honored to work with them.
Dr. Temple, what does the current state of things at Viterbo say about maybe the rest of this semester and what the outlook will be going forward for you?
Yeah, as I previously mentioned, our current rate on campus is very low. So obviously our goal is to keep it there and continue the practices that we've put in place. As we look forward into spring semester, I think a question for me, and things will work with the county health department and the strike force, is on what's the right testing protocol as we bring students back in the spring semester to again start start safely as we go. Like Roger, we are going to mirror many of the same steps that we have planned with smaller classes and some courses hybrid, and the safety precautions all in place. We expect that will be the case. We have canceled spring break, as I know UWL has done, I think, in their planning. And that reflects that our athletic teams are not going to be taking trips and we're not going to be doing study abroad trips. But our Student Government Association did really want some days off interspersed. So we will have some days sprinkled off throughout the semester for some mental health days, as they refer to them as. So we're trying to work with our students to figure out the path forward to keep us safe. And as Roger indicated, our faculty and staff are going above and beyond and are very tired. So trying to do what we can to support them and keep our community and our students safe will be the priority.
Chancellor Gao, what about UWL? What's the immediate future looking like on campus?
Well, we are feeling, I don't know what word you'd say, relieved about the amount of virus in the residence halls and the testing that we're doing with students. We're fortunately able to, when we do have someone test positive, get them into quarantine or isolation. So we're, guardedly optimistic there about that population. In order to address off-campus students, we are now doing more testing of that group, and so hopefully we will find similar trends there. The thing I guess that we're all up against is, we're having to implement measures that are unusual for humans. We do want to shake hands, and we do want to be in groups with one another, and just have a meal, that kind of thing. And we're not going to be able to do that for a long time. And that, I think, is, one of the hardest parts of this is just getting people to say, okay, I accept this and I'll do my part. And, we don't want fatigue to set in and people to get careless. So it's going to take a lot of discipline. And, we're certainly gearing up for that.
Well, I certainly want to express my appreciation to each of you for the work that you're doing in our community and certainly for joining us on the program today. We've been speaking with Chancellor Joe Gao from the University of Wisconsin-La Crosse. Chancellor Gao, thank you very much.
Thank you, Ezra. Pleasure, and always great to be with Glenna and Roger. And I think we have something very special in La Crosse when it comes to higher education and the collaboration that we all do.
Indeed so. And Dr. Roger Stanford is the president of Western Technical College. Dr. Stanford, thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you, everybody. And thanks for my colleagues here. We do truly try to work together so that we're all unified.
And Dr. Glenna Temple is the president of Viterbo University. Dr. Temple, thank you indeed for being here today.
Thank you for the important conversation. And I echo the collaboration comments from my colleagues. And I also want to do a shout out to the community. We've received a lot of help from our community partners to be able to do this, and I know the other schools have as well. So I'm grateful for all the ways that this city and this county have supported us.
Absolutely, and I'm certainly grateful for the three of you joining us today here on Newsmakers. Again, if you'd like to catch part of this show that you might have missed or a previous episode, you can find it on our website, which is wpr.org/newsmakers. There are several opportunities each week to catch the show. You can find our original broadcast, 10 a.m. on Fridays on the Ideas Network, 90.3 in La Crosse. You can hear our repeat at 7 p.m. on Friday or 5 a.m. on Saturday on La Crosse's WLSU 88.9. And again, you can find us always on the website, wpr.org/newsmakers. My thanks today to Dawn Jewell for her assistance producing the program, and the rest of La Crosse staff, and I hope you'll join us next time for another Newsmakers right here on Wisconsin Public Radio.